All right, Debbie, you're up. Take it away.
Thank you, Super Dave. I love your name. Hey, y'all, my name is Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 25th of 1990, by God's grace, and because Alcoholics Anonymous works, the old timers told me it works 100% guaranteed, and they showed me that it worked 100% guaranteed, and that's been true for me so far, even when I was barely holding on by my toenails. And I'm so grateful for the old timers, and I love the old timers. Jim, thank you so much for being here today. It brought tears to my eyes just to have you in the meeting. And you know, I hope to be you someday. Anyway, the old timers give me hope. I was 27 when I got sober. I didn't really believe that I was really, really an alcoholic, like not like Bill Wilson, like not like that old geezer. I was newly divorced. I was a single mom. I had little kids and I didn't have much money. And I didn't have anybody to keep my kids very much, but I managed to make 90 meetings in 90 days. But I want to just tell you how I got here. I was married to an alcoholic, and my stepmother had gotten sober. And I called her one day, just, you know, the family is just ravaged by the disease of alcoholism. And I was married to that guy for 6 years, and I didn't drink for most of those 6 years. But I called her one day, and I'm crying, and I said, I just can't live like this anymore. Our family life was so crazy. And, you know, we'd had another knockdown drag out over his drinking. And she said, well, he needs to go to AA, and you need to go to Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon, and my little girl was a month old. I remember I took her in her little car seat, and I put on, you know, my best outfit I could still fit in after having a baby, and I fixed my hair up. It was 1989, so you can imagine it was a lot of hair and a lot of makeup. That mask, I put that mask on and went to that Al-Anon meeting, and those ladies were going around the room, and they said, well, the alcoholic is sick, but we're sick too. And they got about halfway around the room, and I just couldn't take it anymore, and I said, excuse me, yes, he's sick, he's an alcoholic, and he does all these things wrong, but I mean, me, I'm not sick. I take out the trash, I mow the yard, I pay the bills, I take care of the kids, I take care of the dogs, I just run everything basically, and you can't tell me I'm sick too. There's nothing wrong with me. He's the problem. And they all started laughing, and they said, just keep coming back, Debbie. And here's the thing, I was so isolated by the disease of alcoholism. I didn't have any friends left in my life. And my sisters and my mom really, and my stepmom, they didn't really want to hear anything I had to say, because all I did was complain about him constantly and talk about all the insanity. And they were just done, really just, you know, didn't want to hear any more of it. So I was very isolated. We lived way out in the country, and I didn't have any friends, and I was lonely. So, you know, those ladies at the Al-Anon meeting hugged me and told me to keep coming back. And I'm so grateful for Al-Anon for introducing me to the 12 steps. And I went to Al-Anon just long enough to get the courage to leave my husband. And that's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's my experience, is because of the relationship I had with him, I didn't, and because of my own illness, you know, I was spiritually ill. I didn't have any boundaries, and I didn't know how to say no or stand up for myself, or was unwilling, whatever, I don't know. But Al-Anon gave me just enough courage to get out. And that's not everyone's story, or whatever, what happens to everyone. And I respect and admire so many people who recovered together and were able to stay together and stay married after getting sober and getting into Al-Anon. But that wasn't my story. And I'm forever grateful that I was able to get my children out of that home. And so when I was in Al-Anon 5 months, I left him. And I was going to Al-Anon, and every chance I got, I would go out drinking. and I was only knew about these two Al-Anon meetings. It was the same group. They met on Tuesday night and Friday night at the big Methodist church. And it seemed like all the guys in the AA meeting there weren't any guys in the Al-Anon meeting, but I wouldn't have liked them anyway. But there were all the guys in the AA meeting were old. And I said to the Al-Anon ladies one night, where's all the young guys? And they said, oh, you need to go to the Brazos Club. Well, the Brazos Club is the AA club in Bryan College Station, which is my hometown and where I sobered up. And So I went over there to check it out. They did have an Al-Anon meeting there, so I went for the Al-Anon meeting, and lo and behold, there's lots of guys, and they got all kinds of fun things going on. I was so excited because I was young, and I'm a very extroverted type of a person, and I like to have a good time. So they were having dances, and they were having, you know, campouts, and they were going bowling, and they were going play volleyball in the park, and they had a softball team on the city league, and and hanging out there just, you know, between meetings, socializing. And I mean, it was the fellowship I craved. And I'm so grateful. I sobered up at that club, and I'm so grateful for that club. So I kept going to Al-Anon and drinking for it was 18 months in Al-Anon before I finally drank enough to get in the other door. But I remember close to the end of that time, I went to a women's retreat, an Al-Anon women's retreat in October. And this is how God works in my life. I walked over into this women's AA meeting and I said, "Hey, is anybody in here going to the women's retreat? Do you need a ride?" And this gal named Georgette said, "Sure, I'll ride with you." And it's like I thought she asked me for a ride and she thought I asked her to ride with me. That's how God works. And I spent that entire weekend talking about my drinking. And she never once, this is one of the things I'm so grateful for and I loved about Al-Anon and AA in that time. Everybody understood the traditions very clearly, and everybody knew they had no business telling me what I was. I needed to figure that out. Nobody in Al-Anon ever said, "Get out of here. You're in the wrong room. Go to AA." Nobody ever did that. They just kept loving and they kept smiling and saying, "We love you. Keep coming back." And they let me get as miserable as I needed to get, before I, you know, became to my own awakening, my own awareness. But there's nothing more miserable than an alcoholic going to Al-Anon and drinking. It's pretty, well, there may be other things, but for me, that was pretty miserable. And so that weekend, I forged a new relationship with Georgette, and I'm so grateful because a month later in November, the weekend of Thanksgiving, my ex-husband picked up the kids and on Wednesday night, and I went out drinking, and I did a lot of things that I said I'd never do with people I didn't know. And I woke up the next morning, I'm like, "Oh God, I didn't mean for this to happen." So I called my Al-Anon sponsor, and she gave me some suggestions, which weren't stop drinking. They were some tools of Al-Anon. And I, you know, spent the day working on that and went out drinking that night. Same thing happened. Call her the next day. She gives me some more suggestions. I mean, it was just like every night I couldn't not go drink. And I wasn't to the point physically in my life where I had to have a drink every single day. I didn't drink every day. I didn't get drunk every time I drank. But when I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. It's Russian roulette for me. The book talks about that, you know, that once I set off that compulsion, that allergy, the craving, the phenomenon of craving starts after I swallow alcohol. Before that, it's just a mental obsession. And I'm just thinking, you know, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent and crazy. And I need something to make me feel better. And, you know, then I take that drink and I'm off and running and I don't know what I'm going to do. And I don't know who I'm going to do it with. And I don't know where I'm going to do it. And I don't know where I'm going to end up. I might be okay. Like lots of days, there was like, I'm like a normal drinker. And then there comes the time that I don't know that things happen that I'm horrified by and that other people are horrified by. And, you know, I want to say that from the time I started drinking, I don't remember ever crossing a line in my drinking. I was a teenager when I started drinking regularly. And when I was a teenager, I was crossing the line regularly. I had blackouts. I, you know, peed in my pants. I puked. I came to in places that I didn't mean to be with people I didn't mean to be with from the beginning of my drinking. And so there was never there was a progression as far as the my reaction to alcohol over time, but there was never a progression of the thing being set off in me. And it was from the beginning. I didn't develop alcoholism. I believe I was born with alcoholism. I've always been spiritually different ever since I can remember. I've had a hole in my soul that needed to be filled by something. And what I know now is that, you know, that feeling that I've always had inside that needed something to make me feel better, that felt like a yearning, longing for something. Like I'm missing something. I need something. I've had it ever since I can remember. And I believe now that God gave me that feeling to cause me to seek him out. Like, it's a God-given instinct to seek him out. But I'm an alcoholic, and I don't like it. I don't like how it feels. And I'm self-will run riot, so I run around doing all kinds of things to fix that feeling, make it go away. And ever since I can remember as a little girl, I was doing something to try to change how I felt. And it, you know, thankfully for me, it didn't become alcohol until I was about 16 years old. I'm grateful for that. I did experiment with alcohol starting when I was about 12 or 13, but it didn't really become readily available to me until I was a teenager. So anyway, I heard Tom Brady say one time that feeling that I'm talking about feels like it's like we lost looking for the way home, and that alcohol is a liar, and it made it feel like it was home. Like the alcohol made it feel like it changed that, it filled up that hole, it changed that feeling, but it's temporary, right? And it's false. So anyway, that Thanksgiving weekend, I drank every single night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, and woke up every morning going, oh my God, what did I do? Well, that last night, I had been talking to some guys at the AA club. I wasn't talking to any women, not about to, but I was talking to some guys, and they would say things to me like, people who aren't alcoholic never wonder if they're alcoholic. There's nothing for them to wonder about. You know, like that would just take all the wind out of my sails as far, because I was expecting to be able to explain why I'm not an alcoholic. And then they'd say, people who aren't alcoholic don't try to control their drinking because they don't have to. What? I don't understand. And, you know, nobody said, Debbie, wise up, you dummy. You're in the wrong room. They just let me keep drinking until I figured it out. So that night, that Saturday night, I was sitting by a campfire at the end of that night with some people I went to high school with, drinking keg beer. I don't even like keg beer, but that was the last alcohol I ever drank. And as I poured the last of that cup down my throat, I tilted that cup back, and as it was going down my throat, I thought, I'm pouring beer in a God-shaped hole. What? Where did that? I don't even know where that thought came from. I don't know where it came from, but I mean, I know it's from God, but I know that now. But at the time, I was like, what? So I knew that one of those guys would be up at the Kettle. I don't know if y'all know what Kettle is, but it's like a pancake house, you know, like an IHOP or something. And he threw the paper, so he was always up there in the middle of the night. So I thought, I'm going to go up there and talk to Harry. So I went and found Harry, and, you know, I said, I don't know, but I think I might, maybe, I don't know. I couldn't even say the phrase, I'm an alcoholic. Like, that word could not come out of my mouth in relation to me. And he just smiled and nodded, and he gave me a ride home because he didn't want me driving because I was drunk, and he came back and got me the next morning. And, you know, it was a terrible night. I was tossing and turning. I was pouring, like, alcohol was just coming out of my pores. I was sweating alcohol. Everybody knows how that feels, right? And I called my Al-Anon sponsor the next morning, and I said, I think I might be going to an AA meeting to get a desire chip. I think I might be an alcoholic. And she said, I think you need to get on your bed, on your knees beside your bed right now, and ask God to show you the truth, and then get up and go do the next right thing. And again, she didn't say, God, you finally wised up, girl. You're in the right, going to go to the right room. She let me, she let me do what I needed to do. And I don't remember anything that was talked about at that meeting. I don't know what the topic of the meeting was. I remember it was a big meeting. It was a lot of guys whose wives went to Al-Anon with me. And all I could think was, they're going to go home and tell their wives that I was at the AA meeting getting a chip. And that's what I remember. And I remember this one other thing. There was a guy sitting next to me named Derek. Derek and I went to high school and junior high together. He lived two houses down from me when I was growing up. He had a big halo brace on his leg because he'd been in a motorcycle wreck, drunk and drunk and high. And over all the years that I lived in Bryan College Station and was active in AA there, he would periodically come to AA court ordered and attend some meetings. But Derek never said, my name is Derek and I'm an alcoholic. Derek never picked up a desire chip. Derek did not consistently go to meetings. He didn't get a sponsor. And Derek died of the disease a few years ago by his own hand. And I don't ever want to forget Derek. I don't know why Derek didn't stay sober and I did, because if I was looking at him and me, you know, like looking at the outside consequences of what our lives were looking like at that time, he definitely needed to be sober. I wasn't really sure if I needed to stay sober. I wasn't really planning on being 29 and a half years sober at that time. I just really wanted to stop hating myself and be able to look myself in the eye in the mirror, you know, and I just really hated how I felt, and I wanted to be things to change. And I had tried many, many times before AA to fix me, mostly through my church and through pulling myself up by my bootstraps. I would get real involved in my church again, and I would think, I'm going to straighten up and act right. I'm going to be a good girl. I'm not going to do this anymore. And I wanted to as much as anybody could ever want to, and I meant it as much as anybody could ever mean it. And what our book says is we had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we had lack of power. Like, the needed power was not there. And I didn't know that. I thought if I just prayed enough and read my Bible enough and went to enough church and made myself be good, that everything would be all right. But when I was, this is not a knock against church. I love my church. My higher power has never changed. But when I was at church, they say that it's our secrets that keep us sick. And Chuck Chamberlain said that anything that cuts me off from you cuts me off from God. Well, when I would be at church and I would listen to the preacher, and then I would look at those nice, pretty people, you know, married couples and the families. And I thought that what the preacher was talking about and what they looked like on the outside was what they were really like. That was their insides too. And my insides were not like their, what they looked like on the outside. And also my home life was chaotic. You know, my parents were drinking and getting divorces, and there was a lot of craziness going on, and they were pretty absent a lot. So I was the teenager in charge of the other kids, and we were doing whatever we wanted. So my outside life didn't look like what I thought their outside lives probably looked like. And actually, I visited some of their homes, and their outside lives did seem pretty different from mine. So I felt very cut off from, because I thought if they really knew me and really knew what my life was like, that they wouldn't let me sing in the choir. They wouldn't let me go to Sunday school. They wouldn't let me go on mission trips. They wouldn't let me go to church camp. And I was the only member of my family going to that church. So I was always cut off. And what I know is that the disease of alcoholism wants to kill, steal, and destroy me. And that's what it was doing. You know, it centers in my mind, and it tells me nobody understands. Nobody's like me. I can't tell anybody my secrets. And so I was always cut off. And it's one of the things that I absolutely love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that our worst sickness and ugliness, our worst acts, are the things that bring us together. I'm so grateful for that, to be a member of this organization. So I called Georgette and asked her to meet me at that meeting that day, and she became my first sponsor. And I'm so grateful for her to this day. Georgette's no longer sober. She goes to Al-Anon some, and she doesn't, we're not friends anymore. I mean, I would still be her friend, but she doesn't want to be my friend. So whatever. God bless her and change me. Right. But I'm so forever grateful for her, and I'll never forget her. She gave me my very first big book, and I want to show you this big book. This cover was made for me by, a guy in prison. And this book was printed in 1963, which is the year I was born. She worked at Half Price Books, and she bought this book for like a dollar. When I got it, it didn't have a single pen mark in it. So I think whoever had it before me maybe didn't stay sober. I don't know. But this is my big book that I got sober with, and it doesn't have page 449 or page 417. It does not have the story, Dr. Alcoholic Addict. It does not have... acceptance was the key in it. So I loved it. At the time, you know, I'd be complaining about all my problems in the AA meeting, and people would say, page 449. And I would say, that's not in my book. So I love that book. I got to tell you a quick story about Willard. Everybody knows Willard M., I'm sure, who used to live. He started the Rule 62 group down there in Devine, and now he lives up in Austin. He was the speaker at, it's saying my internet connection is unstable. I hope y'all can hear me. He was the speaker at the Southeast Texas Area Convention in 2008. I was the co-chair, and we were hosting it in Bryan College Station. And he was the Saturday night speaker, and he was the only speaker I actually got to go hear because of everything else I had going on that, you know, with the convention that weekend. And I went, and I was 18 years sober at the time. I was restless, irritable, and discontent with some stuff in my life. And I was kind of having that alcoholic thinking of, you know, I've been sober this long. I'm tired of these people. I'm tired of this stuff. And this is all there is, you know, very wrapped up in self. And I went and sat in the back of the room, and he was the speaker that night. And one of the things that I adore about Willard is that he's so freaking funny. And I mean, he made me laugh. And he also has a great love for AA history and AA literature, as do I. And he started talking about that, and it made me think about my big book that God sent me, and the fact that it was written, it was printed in 1963, the year I was born. And I thought about the path that book must have taken to get into my hands. And it was like God just hit me in the head with that book via Willard's hands and said, Debbie, why, you dummy, this is my love letter to you. You belong here. So I'm so grateful. Willard has got special meaning to me, and I always remind him of that whenever I get to see him or talk to him. I don't know if I would have kept coming to AA if it hadn't been for that night, that another moment of clarity, right? So I did picked up a desire chip that day, and I thought, well, I don't know if I'm really, really an alcoholic, but I'm going to just go to a meeting every day just because nobody can fault me for not drinking. And I've been quitting drinking a lot of times in my life, so nobody can fault me for that. And I didn't drag my kids out to a meeting every night. I went to the two meetings at the church that had a babysitter, but the rest of the time I was blessed to be able to go to noon meetings so that I could go home at night and be a decent mom to my kids and give them a routine and a bed, you know, dinner and a bath and bedtime at a regular time. And, you know, AA gave me structure and directions for how to live one day at a time, doing the next right thing. I mean, everything was so chaotic and my brain was so chaotic. I couldn't focus, and I call my sponsor and I dump, you know, just puke all these problems all over her. And she'd say, are your dishes washed? And I think, did she hear what I said? And she'd say, go wash your dishes and call me back. you know, or the next time I call her, she'd say, is your laundry done? go do a load of laundry and call me back. one time I called her, and I was going on and on about these problems. She said, hey, how's Molly doing? And I thought, what on earth is this? Does she not hear what I said? I don't care how Molly's doing. You know, that's what I'm thinking to myself. But what she was trying to teach me to do was to take the next right action, do the next indicated right thing, and to stop thinking about myself so much and think about other people. And I'm so grateful for those really simple lessons. I mean, to this day, that is how I live my daily sobriety. Like, I spend my day texting other people and asking them how they're doing, or calling people and asking them how they're doing, or trying to do the next right thing. I get up and roll out of bed on my knees, and I ask God to guide and direct my thoughts and actions. And then I get up and take the next right action as if He is guiding, directing my thoughts and my actions. I do my laundry. I make my bed. I, you know, clean my house. I go for a walk. I get dressed and brush my teeth, for God's sake. And that's been the saving grace, that knowing how to do that routine, daily sober living, daily. Just what am I doing today? That's what's kept me from going crazy in this corona. So anyway, get back to the steps. I didn't think I needed to do steps 1, 2, and 3 because I'm a Christian, and I thought, well, you can't tell me anything about God. I've already got that relationship down, so let's just move on. But the fact of the matter is that I didn't live as if I had a relationship with God, and I didn't act like I had a relationship with God. And I was constantly playing this, like, God's the magic genie, and I'm going to wish, you know, like, rub his belly really hard and wish really hard, please grant me my wishes, God. Or I treat him like a vending machine. Like, I did this, 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 and this, and now I want you to do what I said. And, you know, like, let me put my money in and push the button and get what I want out of there. I didn't ever really turn my will and my life over or surrender. And my sponsor made it really simple for me. She said, your will is your thoughts, and your life is your actions, and you're just going to ask God to guide and direct those on a daily basis. And then you're going to get up and take the action as if He is. That's all there is to it. I wanted to be like a cosmic orgasm or something, you know, like, ooh, like some kind of fantastic, sparkly, electrifying experience that would blow my socks off. And I, you know, I periodically have some experiences like that. But most of the time it's just really the more of the educational variety. And a lot of it is really letting go and letting go of old ideas and getting rid of preconceived notions and closed-minded thoughts and opening up, you know, realizing that I have a human brain. I can't possibly comprehend the fullness of what God is. But I know there is one and he's not me. That's the most important thing. I'm not the higher power, right? And the way that we turn our will and our lives over is by working the rest of the steps. So I had started an Al-Anon fourth step. She said, let's just try to finish that and get it done so you can get on with the rest of the steps. And when we did my fifth, it was like lancing a boil. I mean, just ugliness and pent up anger and resentment and bitterness and pain and anguish just poured out. And I had trained myself for years not to cry. And I wanted to be like my dad and not cry. And so anytime I had an emotion like that was thought it seemed like it was going to be a cry, bam, I was just clamp it down. I'm not going there. And so I was able to just cry years of uncried tears. And, you know, what became true for me from the book is that it was clear that there was plenty of people who'd done plenty wrong, but that I was not a victim, that I had chosen the role I played, and that what I learned about working the steps is that it's not about what other people did and if that's my fault that they did things. I can only do something about myself. And my responsibility is always, how do I react to what other people or things are doing in my life? And what do I do with it after that? Like, do I use it as a club to continue to beat myself? Do I use it as a weapon to beat you? Do I use it as an excuse for bad behavior? Do I use it as a tool to cause pain? And that's really all those things I just mentioned are things that I did. I, you know, continually beat myself up and other people, emotionally and verbally about things that had happened in the past. I was very, vindictive and bitter and full of self-pity. And it was an awful way to live. And I'm so grateful I don't have to live like that anymore. So, I did the very best four step I could do. It wasn't perfect. I did the best fifth step I could do. It wasn't perfect. And I moved on. That first time we did step five and six and seven, I don't really remember a lot about it, but I'll tell you that I've had some great experiences working with sponsors on six and seven. And I always want to talk about it because there's not much said about six and seven, but I used to say, and I think a lot of people in early sobriety especially will say this, well, I'm working on my character defects. I'm working on my patience. I'm working on my pride or whatever. Well, that kind of implies that I have some power, and I don't have any power. I'm powerless. So what the seventh step says is that I get on my knees and I ask God to remove whatever he thinks is stands in the way of my usefulness to him and my fellows. And some of the things that I think are bad that should be removed, he can use for good. Sometimes I'm just the best bad example for somebody else. But sometimes, you know, something like obstinance that I have can be, the positive of that can be persistence. And I can use that defect as a trait to get things accomplished. So, and I don't know what's good. I don't know what's bad. I have to let God decide that. And so I don't ask God to make me patient. I don't ask God to make me kind. I don't ask God to make me anything except for what he wants me to be, whatever that is. And that's my practice of step seven. To me, six and seven are just like six is the ideal and seven is reality. Like six is how I really, you know, we ought to be. And then there's the fact that I can't live up to it. So I got to have seven to get, you know, ask God to help me get on with it. So just a little bit about that stepmom. My dad left us when he was 30 for her, and she was 18 years old. She's only 6 years older than me. And I was 12 when that happened. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of pain and bitterness and awful family drama around her. And God used her to get me to Al-Anon so that I could get sober eventually. And so, you know, when I first saw the steps and I saw that there was an amends step, I was like, there is no way I'm ever making amends to her, not her. And as the this is what's so important about working the steps in order with a sponsor is each step spiritually prepares us for the next step so that when we do get to that step, what seemed like something that was impossible to do becomes the possible thing to do. And the steps prepared me to be able to make amends to that woman first. And because I made amends to her first, all the rest of them were easy. And I'm so grateful for that. My stepmom isn't sober anymore. And which makes me really sad. But I reminded her a few years ago, I asked her, do you remember what year it was you got sober? And she said, no, I don't remember anymore. And I said, well, I don't know if you remember this, but I went to Al-Anon. I called you one day because of Ray's drinking. And you told me I had to go to Al-Anon and he had to go to AA. And I want you to know how grateful I am for you and for that message that you gave me, because I wouldn't be sober without it. And I wouldn't have the life I have today without that. And she started crying and I started crying, and she said, oh my gosh, I didn't even remember that. Thank you so much for telling me. And it blew my mind that she doesn't even remember. She didn't even remember that that had happened. Like, that's, to me, the disease of alcoholism is stealing her, you know, her, the good life. It's pretty sad to me. Anyway, I'm so grateful for her to this day. And I'm grateful for AA allowing me to have a relationship with her in spite of the past, in spite of how our lives started in each other's lives. So I made amends to her. I did my best to make amends to everyone else on the list. And, you know, some of the amends that I made, I thought would be easy. And they were, like, my sister was like, I don't want to talk about this stuff. Why do we have to bring this up? Let's don't, it doesn't matter anymore. And, you know, and then other, my dad, like, wanted to philosophize about, you know, whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter what they did. It matters that I did the right thing. You know, we make amends to, other people so that we can be clear with God. You know, we clean that wreckage up so that we can be free and clear to be, have a clear relationship with God, and it, because it's the right thing to do. And something that I had to learn the hard way was that, you know, we hear this term a lot in AA, my side of the street. Well, saying that there's my side of the street implies that you have a side of the street. And, the book says that we disregard the other person's actions entirely. Entirely means not at all. So there is no your and my side of the street. I'm only concerned with my own behavior and my own actions. So I don't use that term anymore. I used to, but I don't anymore because, you know, I continue to try to learn more about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and myself and how it applies to me. And I believe that to be true today. What I do is I clean up the wreckage of my past. And there's plenty of that. So if I stay focused on myself and my wreckage of my past, I don't have time to be thinking about anybody else's behavior or business. I'm so grateful for the freedom that the amends brought me. And as I, oh, it's saying my internet connection is unstable again. I sure hope y'all can hear me. So anyway, steps 10, 11, and 12, I want to, you know, step 10 just is that continuing. Tom Brady said it was a walking around step. It's not a wait till at the end of the at night step. The night thing is actually step 11, if you read the book correctly. But walking around step 10 is like, if I harm somebody, I make amends quickly. I do it immediately. And, so if I know there's something that I've done wrong, I know in my heart that I got to do something about it immediately so that I can be free. But one time I called my sponsor and, you know, because of that family history I just told you about, you can imagine there's a lot of dysfunction and family drama. And I called my sponsor one day crying and whining about how poorly my family was treating me. And she says, well, do they have a program of recovery to help them find a better way of life and behave better? And I said, heck no. And I didn't say heck, but I definitely was in judgment of them when I said it, and I meant it. And she said, well, do you have a program of recovery to help you have a better way of life and live a better way? And I said, heck yeah, like I was better than them, you know. And she said, well, act like it. And I thought, dang it. Why does she keep, why does it always have to be about me? But God, I love that sponsor. I'm so grateful for those sponsors that are, they don't care how we feel, right? They care what we do. And one time one of my sponsors says, the book does not say why it works. It says how it works. It doesn't matter why. Just do it. you know, and they would say, we don't care how you feel. We care what you do. And what I know, about that is that if I put too much emphasis on my emotions and my feelings and how things make me feel and all of that, I get way off kilter. I get off the beam real quick if I'm focused way too much on my emotions. If I put my emphasis on my actions instead, and off of your actions, but stay focused on my own actions and what's the next right thing I can do right now? There's a lot of things I can do. I can take a hot bubble bath. I can go for a walk. I can call somebody else and ask them how they're doing. I can read some literature. I can pray. I can write some stuff down. I can go clean the club. I can go for a drive. There's so many actions that I can take that are the next right actions to take. And if I do that, instead of focusing on how I feel, then how I feel changes based on the positive actions. It always changes. That's worked for me. That is a tool that I continue to use every single day of my sobriety. And I'm so grateful for that. I was an emotional ping pong ball when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so grateful to not have to be a reaction based on my emotions or reactionary ping pong ball anymore. How other people act is not how I feel, and it's not how I act, no matter how offensive it may seem. And I'm so grateful for that freedom. It says somewhere in our book that we gave people the power to kill when we give them the power over our emotions. And I don't want anybody else to have that power over me, and I don't want that power over anybody else. So the last step, obviously, step 12, I've had the opportunity to sponsor a lot of women in sobriety and a few guys. I generally think that women should stick with women and men should stick with men, but sometimes things just aren't that way. So I've actually had a guy sponsor in my life for a period of time, and it was what I needed at the time, and I'm grateful for it. And then when it became clear I needed a woman sponsor again, I got one. I sponsor a guy now who is he's gay, so it's the racial relationship we both need in that for his sobriety I'm good with that. Here's one of the things that I wanted to say. I'm not kind of an idealist kind of a person. I really wanted to have like the one sponsor till death do us part. That's what I wanted. I wanted that, you know, that thing that you hear people talk about. But the way my God planned my life, I've had, I don't know, maybe 12 or so sponsors in my sobriety. And it's, some of it's been because I moved. Some of it's been because I've had two sponsors fire me because they said, one of them told me she was jealous of the good things happening in my life. And one of them told me she didn't want to hear my fifth step because, well, I don't know why. She didn't say why. She just said she didn't want to hear it. And I don't know why, but it wasn't because I was being a bad sponsee. When I moved, I got the opportunity actually to get a sponsor that, when I moved down to Corpus, she helped me so much in my sobriety. And one of the things that she would constantly say is, well, let's just look at that with no judgment. And I was 18 years sober when I moved down to Corpus. And I thought, man, I'm Miss AA, man. I know what I'm doing. And this is going to be no step for a stepper. And I got down there and life was very different. And my work was very challenging physically, emotionally, and mentally. And I would go to a meeting and in Bryan College Station, I was one of the old timers in most of the meetings I went to. And I'm not saying that because I'm bragging on myself. I'm saying that was just the way it was. And I would go to the meeting and I'd be like the only one with over 10 years often. And there wasn't a lot of people going to the meetings that I went to that had a lot of time. And I go down to Corpus and there's a lot of retirees there and I'd be in a room of 50 people and over half the room would have more sobriety than me. And it's, while it's a very comforting feeling, and I loved that about living in the coastal bend, it's also a feeling because of, you know, where my pride and ego and my alcoholism come from, it's like nobody even knows if I'm lying or not. You know, that's what the disease of alcoholism centers in the mind, and it's wanting to cut me off from you people. And it would tell me things like that. And so, it was a real difficult time, and I'm so grateful for Cynthia becoming my sponsor at that time. She would often say, let's look at it with no judgment. There is no right or wrong. There's just consequences. And she helped me to see that even with that much time sober and even with all the information and education and book studying that I had done in AA, that I still had a head that was constantly, I'm constantly judging him. Is this right or wrong? Are you right or wrong? Should you have said that or should you have not said that? Is that a right thought? Is that a right action? I mean, it just constant judgment. And it really helped me a lot to learn how to take a step back from everything, including what's going on up here, and wear it more like a loose garment and not have to take it all so seriously, I guess. I remember calling her at one point. There was a lot of difficulty going on with work. There was a lot of difficulty going on with my marriage. And I called her, and I had that burning cold feeling right here in my throat. And I said, I want a drink today. And that was a pretty scary feeling to be sober at that point, maybe around 20 years, and having that strong feeling to want to drink so bad. And at that time, one of the things that was going on in my life was my sister, my baby sister, Christy, who was my half sister. She's my stepmom and my dad's daughter. She was drinking herself into oblivion and in and out of the emergency room, to unconsciousness. And I was thinking, oh my God, I'm, 20 something years sober. I've got to save my sister. And my sponsor would say, does she know you're an AA? Yes, ma'am. Has she asked you for help? No, ma'am. All right, leave her alone, love her, and be her sister. She knows you're an AA. She'll ask you if she wants your help. And that was a really hard thing to do, to give my sister the grace and dignity that God gave her, to have her own relationship with alcohol and her own relationship with him. And her path was that she drank until she died. And 7.5 years ago, my sister died of alcoholism. She was 36 years old, and she laid in her bed and drank vodka until her organs failed. And I couldn't stop it. Like, there was nothing. I was so powerless over alcohol. And what I learned about that is that sobriety is very personal. I can't give anyone else the willingness to go to any length. I can't give anyone else the desire to stop drinking. I can't not swallow alcohol for anyone else. I can't flip the top of their head open and pour all the knowledge I have. I can't beat them over the head with the big book. I can't do anything for them except for if they want, because AA is for people who want it, not people who need it. Then it's my job to lay the kit of spiritual tools at their feet. And then it's their job to pick them up and use them. And whenever Mickey, one of my sponsors, my past sponsors, found out that my sister had died. She was out of town, but she texted me and she said, Father Martin said that every alcoholic is guaranteed sobriety. Some get it in this life. Some get it in the next. And when I read that text, I want you to know that from that, before that moment, I was sure that this was a horrible thing that had happened, and I had been powerless to stop it, and I was upset, and I was angry, and I was in pain and remorse, all the terrible feelings that go along with that, thinking that somehow I should have been able to save my sister, and that I not being in acceptance. My friend Frank Clancy always said, I can say his last name because he's passed away, and a long time ago, but he would say that all pain is self-centered, because it's concerned with self. So during that experience of my sister dying, I really came to know what he meant. Like, I didn't want her to die. I didn't want her to lay in bed and drink vodka. I wanted her to go to AA and accept that she was an alcoholic and get sober. That was all based in self, like self-centered. So when I read that text from Mickey, I was just washed up, flooded with relief, because what I knew in that moment was that my sister got sober for good and for real, and that she's no longer suffering under the lash of alcoholism. This world and alcoholism were too much for her. And it's not a case of I'm right and I figured out how to do it right and she's wrong and she couldn't figure it out. It's a case of we have a different path to the same place, the same God, and the same relationship with God. So that gave me so much freedom and so much relief, and I'm so thankful for her for sending me that message that day, and I pass it on every chance I get to anyone who has lost someone or is about to lose someone from the disease of alcoholism. So I haven't had a chance to talk much about service work, but I just want to point out the triangle has three sides: unity, recovery, and service is on the bottom. When I was a couple of months sober, we had our very first District 33 Unity Conference, and this bossy old lady in AA volunteered me to do something. I don't even remember what it was now. Registration or hospitality suite or bake cookies. I don't know what it was. It doesn't matter what it was. But what happened is I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous in a bigger way. And then a couple of years sober, I started going to, well, I got to be secretary of my group. I got to be treasurer of my group. I got to be GSR. I got to be the speaker getter all different times, you know, in that early sobriety there. I loved being speaker getter because I love parties. And so I was always like, it's Saturday night. We've got a speaker, you know, it's rah-rah for the Saturday night speaker meeting. And I loved that gig. And I got to go to area assembly and started going to district meetings and was able to find out, you know, more about what the service structure is, general service is all about. One thing I do want to say is that there's a difference between doing general service, service work, and 12th step. The 12th step is this 12th step in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I need to work for my own sobriety. But being involved in service to Alcoholics Anonymous is not about my own sobriety. It's about my duty to Alcoholics Anonymous to ensure that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous continues to be to function as it should as a service to alcoholics who suffer and families, you know, to teach them how to get to Al-Anon. It's a duty, and we all have that duty. So I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous in a way bigger way than just being, to me now, the way I look at it is me just going to my home group and talking about myself for an hour at a meeting is about my own sobriety, and it's a little self-centered. But being involved in general service is not about self at all. It's about service to Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And I need a home group, and I need accountability to the people who love me. But I, for my own self, I know that the thing that has ensured long-term, contented, happy, joyous sobriety has been being involved in general service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went to area assembly, and I've been involved in some form in all forms of service to Alcoholics Anonymous ever since the early sobriety, and I'm so grateful for that. Because of it, I feel like I belong to the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have friends all over the country and in other countries. And my, one of my number one goals anytime I'm making a trip anywhere, that, whether it's for pleasure or work, is I look up where's the AA meetings closest to where I'm going to be at, and I make sure to put on my schedule I'm going to attend that day at that time. And I'm so grateful for that. I met Katie, actually. I got assigned by my company to work up in Seattle for, and then in Vancouver, up in the Pacific Northwest for a few months back in 2018, December 2017 to March of 2018. And Katie had just moved up to Seattle, and so Clarissa hooked me up with Katie and another gal named Sherry that some of y'all know. And so I made it a point while I'm there. I've got a rental car and too much free time on my hands at night, staying at a hotel room for an ungodly amount of time. So I made a point to make a dinner date and meeting date with Katie and with Sherry while I was there, and I got to meet a lot of other people in AA. And I'm so grateful. And most of the time I was in the Pacific Northwest, though, I was in Vancouver, Washington, and I was staying in the Hilton downtown Vancouver. There was a bar around every corner and one in the hotel. And there was I looked on the meeting guide app, and there was an AA meeting like five blocks from the hotel. It met at 8 o'clock every night. It was called the Blue Door Group. And I started going, that became my home group while I was there. They were my road tripping home group while I was in Vancouver. And I'm very, very close friends with those people to this day. And I believe without a doubt that had I not been actively participating in that group, I might have ended up drunk. Who knows? But I sure would have been a lot more miserable than I was. I had a lot of fun with them, and they welcomed me into their AA family there. And I'm so grateful for them. The last thing I'll say is that getting back to service work, it's easy. Just, it talks about this in the book. It's easy to practice these principles when I'm in a place that I like, doing with people I like, doing things I like with my home group, going to coffee or whatever, you know, hanging with my homies. It's easy to be happy, joyous, and free in those situations. But when I have to sit down with people that I may not agree with, We have varying, perhaps very diverse opinions about money or property or prestige or how the convention ought to be run or whether we should have, you know, birthday cakes or whatever the topic is. And we all have to sit down and work it out, like really apply the principles of the program and really practice the tools and really learn about what the traditions mean and what the concepts for service mean. Really learn what the service manual says. Really read some of the multitude of other published literature by Alcoholics Anonymous besides just the big book and maybe the 12-12. Read it for real and study it and learn what the real message of all of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole is rather than the perhaps opinioned message from my home group might be. You know, because any of us who are opening our mouth in an AA meeting are pretty much sharing our own experience, which is flavored with a little bit of opinion, perhaps. But if I read the literature, the black ink on the white pages of any information that's published by Alcoholics Anonymous World Services, Inc., that is the voted upon by the General Service Conference approved message of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. That's the real message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that comes from a person is their own personal experience and therefore perhaps a bit of opinion, but including my own. And I think that I love Alcoholics Anonymous way more than I love myself and my little opinion. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous way more than I love my home group. And I have this one grandchild in particular. Oh, she's so extra, y'all. She's kind of like grandma. And I hope that AA is still AA when my little granddaughter, if she needs the hand of AA to be there, that I hope it's there for her. I love you all so much. I'm going to read the 12-step promises, and that's what we're going to close with. This is from Chapter 7, Working with Others, page 89 in the big book. It's the second paragraph. I read these promises because they have come true for me, and they didn't come true for my sister while she was living. And it just really means a lot to me to read these. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And I just want you to know that is so true for me. That is the way I live my life today. And I'm so grateful for this life. I have so much hope and joy for the future because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you for my sobriety. That's all.